Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. And that war is very active at the moment, alas, on the home front. And the good news is that one of the organizations that is actively trying to save our country from enemies foreign and domestic at the moment is Heritage Action. It is a grassroots organization with members all over the country associated with the Heritage Foundation and led by the highly acclaimed Jessica Anderson. We're delighted to have her with us today, drawing on both her experience at Heritage Action and on that she has had as a senior official in the Office of Management and Budget during the Trump administration, to talk about a piece of legislation that we've been discussing a lot here because it is so vitally important that it be understood and challenged and hopefully ultimately defeated. It is called H.R. 1. The actual name of it is For the People, though it seems to be misplaced, that name. And we'll discuss why with Jessica Anderson right now. Jessica, it's so good to have you with us. Welcome, and thank you for the leading role that you and your organization are playing in helping expose the problems with this legislation.
Absolutely, Frank. Great to be with you today. Thank you for having me.
So tell us about the concerns that prompt you to believe this is a piece of legislation that must not pass. Jessica.
Well, H.R. 1 is Speaker Nancy Pelosi's signature piece of legislation. It's her number one priority. And when you look at the bill closely, you realize that her priority is very clear, and it's to rig the election system in favor of the Democrat politicians that have really used the system to their benefit by changing and breaking many of the rules. And so when you look at...
Notably, I mean, this is not just an abstraction. This is what happened in 2020, I believe. And I guess I'm fond of saying if you liked what that was about, you're going to love H.R. 1. Does that sound about right?
That's exactly right. It would federalize everything that happened at the state level in 2020 and make it permanent. And the end goal of H.R. 1 really not only does it enshrine into law very dubious electoral practices that enable and encourage fraud, but it takes it to the next level. So there's provisions on ballot harvesting, false voter registrations, duplicate voting, and ineligible voting. And so it's not just that these provisions are unhelpful, they're unnecessary, but they're also unconstitutional. And when you pick apart, you really see the theme from the left really drawn out for all of us to understand, which is they are not going to stop at simply rigging the rules to advance their agenda. They want to permanently change the rules so that there's no opportunity for conservatives to actually be able to win at the ballot box or feel like our vote is safe and secure. So the bill is incredibly dangerous. We need to fight it with all of our might at the House, Senate level. Pray that it doesn't end up on Biden's desk for signature. He, of course, will ultimately sign this should it land there. And so we have a real opportunity, I think, as conservatives to stand united against this, to talk about the dangers of the bill in specifics, and to work with our House and Senate House members and senators to bolster them to vote no.
I couldn't agree more. And I was struck by a comment that was made recently by one of the fathers of the conservative movement, Richard Viguerie. Just to put a fine point on how important this is, he says, if H.R. 1 becomes law, every issue you care about will be lost forever. And that's because basically it will achieve what the Democrats have long sought, which is kind of a one-party state, which they can, you know, transform fundamentally, to use Obama's phrase, into something that bears no resemblance to our constitutional republic. And Jessica, I think you're right in another respect, as I've been trying to impress on our audience, the numbers of votes that need to be switched to ensure that this legislation does not get to Joe Biden's desk are very small. That doesn't say that it's going to be easy to get them, but it just does put in perspective the challenge. Talk a bit about what Heritage Action is doing to try to mobilize the public, educate them, of course, about what's afoot here, but also to give them ways in which they can personally participate in trying to have this thing come out right rather than desperately wrong.
So there's a few strategies, I think, at play here. One that's short term with the vote coming up in the House this next week, and then the long term play as we look at the nexus with the Senate vote. So first on the short term, there are about 21 red district Democrats. By red districts, I mean the districts that Trump handily won in 2016, likely won in 2020, that are represented by Democrats in the House. These are what we would all consider vulnerable Democrats. They've got a huge constituency back home that are conservative voters, and they're in tune with that, even if they may ignore it. Well, that's the target list for the House. So if you are in a red district like an Abigail Spanberger or Ron Kind, and we've got this whole list on our website, heritageaction.com, you can click the toolkit for election integrity in HR1, see where your member falls, and call them. They need to hear exactly from their constituents in their districts, asking them to vote no and flagging the dangers of the bill. Now, when you talk to a progressive or Democrat about this bill, the best messaging angle is actually one of the second part of HR1, the second provisions in the bill, which are around donor disclosures and donor privacy laws that would be changed, as well as the removal of redistricting power, which would give the power to draw congressional districts to an unelected third party. Those two provisions are the ones that Democrats are uniquely interested in, more so than, let's say, some of the First Amendment rights that we as conservatives are interested in. So if you're thinking about this strategically, our message to Democrats is one of, let's maintain privacy and donor disclosure laws as they exist, protects the First Amendment. If you're talking to a conservative member of Congress, the message is, don't allow HR1 to federalize our election process. Keep the power at the state. Don't rig the game. Don't rig the game in the favor of the left. So it's two different strategies. We outline all of this at heritageaction.com and attach it directly to your members so you know what to say when you call. Now, as we look forward to the Senate, though, really interesting, Frank, because Mitch McConnell has made blocking HR1 his number one priority for the Senate. So it is a divided Senate. We know that we don't have, Republicans don't have all of the power. And so some of this is going to be a little bit of a back and forth between Schumer and McConnell about whether or not F1, as it's called, has a vote in the Senate. If that does happen and it is put on the floor, it is really important to look again at those red state Democrats and putting pressure on them. So that's the list that everyone knows. Senator Manchin of West Virginia, the two senators from Arizona, Senator Kelly and Sinema, the two senators from Georgia, Warnock and Ossoff, Senator Tester in Montana. I mean, these are the senators that need to hear from us. So if you're thinking about it globally, make your calls now. Get your letters to the editor in now. Make sure that members of Congress know where we as conservatives stand on this important issue.
And you can find out how to do that at heritageaction.com. Jessica Anderson, thank you so much for taking the time to talk us through this and for your leadership. Come back to us with updates if you would. Next up, we will speak with former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo about China, its genocide, and its COVID attacks on the United States. That and more, straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
It is with the greatest pleasure and the highest of privilege that I am delighted to welcome back to these microphones an old friend, a man we've talked with many times in the past, but not recently, the former member of Congress from Kansas, the former director of the Central Intelligence Agency, the former Secretary of State of the United States, by my lights, arguably the best ever, at least since Thomas Jefferson's day. His name is Michael Pompeo. He served under President Donald Trump in the latter two capacities, and he is these days a very distinguished fellow of the Hudson Institute, an esteemed organization here in Washington, D.C. It is delightful to have you back, sir. Thank you so much for taking a few minutes to join us.
Thank you. Frank. It's great to be back with you. I enjoyed talking to you for all those years I was a member of Congress from Kansas. We did good work.
We did. You took a little bit of grief for it, it must be said, but you managed to do pretty well notwithstanding, and I'm so appreciative of all your service to our country. Let me ask you, sir, about a piece that you've just published today. I guess it ran online yesterday in the Wall Street Journal, but in the print edition today, with your very able colleague and subordinate at the State Department, Dr. Miles Yu. It's about something that you focused intensively on, and properly so, namely the provenance of the coronavirus, I think is properly described as the CCP, or Chinese Communist Party virus. I think you've used that term on an occasion. China virus, for sure. No longer permissible, by the way. But talk a little bit about, if you would, whence it came, and the degree to which the Chinese Communist Party must be held accountable for the horrific damage that it's done to this country and so many others.
Well, Frank, thanks for taking your attention to this incredibly important issue. So we now have a couple million people who have died, billions of dollars in wealth destroyed. There'll be more people die as a result of that absence of prosperity, right? Money not available to build out electrical plants, all kinds of second, third order implications. This is a central challenge to the world today. Why it matters still, right? So you could argue, well, that's history, but the truth is it's not. The Chinese Communist Party has a history with programs like this. It has a history of underinvesting in security at its biosafety systems, at its laboratories. We've known this for a long time. We naively hoped that the World Health Organization and international rules would prevent them from doing this kind of thing, or if there was a problem, that there'd be sufficient transparency that we could all go track it down and make sure we cabined any virus in a short time with minimal damage. And of course, all that proved folly. All that proved folly when the Chinese Communist Party permitted this virus that came from China to travel around the world. They knew it had human-to-human transmission possibilities, and yet they closed down only Wuhan and not the world. And now we are all suffering for that. And for that, the world needs to hold China accountable. The world needs to hold the international health authorities accountable for their failure to drive transparency and to contain this virus in China. All of those things that the world must take seriously, because in the absence of that, in the absence of a thorough understanding of what took place, you can be certain that someday and sometime something like this will happen again.
Well, there's so many pieces to this, I'm hardly clear where to go next. I did want to just do a shout out to your former colleague, Matt Pottinger, who served, as you of course know, as the Deputy National Security Advisor to the President. And on Sunday, he spoke about this same issue and accountability. And the thing that I thought was really interesting about what he said, Mr. Secretary, was that he felt that what China did by both unleashing this on the world, of course, but also not warning us promptly, and worse, encouraging us to believe that this was really just a bad flu, left us vastly more exposed, to say nothing of the rest of the world, and treating the thing improperly, which again compounded its devastation. Do you agree with that? And when you talk about accountability, what do you have in mind there?
That is absolutely true. You know, we always hear in Washington talk about the cover-up being worse than the crime. In this case, the cover-up and the crime may well have been the same thing. In the sense of, look, there's research conducted in lots of places in the world, but there's a responsibility to do so safely and carefully. And the Chinese Communist Party has demonstrated their incapacity to do that right. This isn't the first one that we've had come from China, right? We had the SARS virus come as well. We don't
know. Some say that most viruses come from China, whatever kind, flu strains and the like.
What we know is this. We know that they're not operating these in a way that is safe and effective and can deliver the levels of security that the global standards require and that the world must hold every nation accountable to. We've seen that a piece of the security is the capacity to admit when there's been a mistake or there's something gone on inside of your country, and the Chinese did just the opposite. Look, it's the nature. Frank, you and I come at this as people who saw the Soviet Union for exactly what it was. We saw that communist nations, dictatorships, regimes like this can't possibly tell the truth in times of crisis. It's not possible. The Soviet Union didn't do it during Chernobyl. The list is long, and so they covered up. They hid it from their own people, and they hid it from the world.
One of the things that is so troubling about this, though, I have to say, and I was sort of surprised that you and Dr. Yu didn't get into it, but I would like to just momentarily here, and that is part of the problem with this, of course, is not just a lack of safety. It's the fact that the Chinese Communist Party is engaged in an illegal biological weapons program. I think the State Department has acknowledged that for years now, but it's sort of striking to me, Secretary Pompeo, that we haven't heard more about that in this bill of particulars, let alone in terms of talking about accountability.
So, Frank, your point's well taken. In this sense, we, in our piece in the Wall Street Journal, were aimed particularly at what was taking place in this place, and we were trying to hew very closely to the things we know and the things we do not know. And it's the darndest thing, because the things we don't know is a very long list, and we don't know them because the Chinese Communist Party has moved heaven and earth to prevent us all from knowing them. Indeed, when the final tabs are shown from this WHO recent effort of investigation, I think we'll find that no true scientist, no true virologist would say that they got the information they needed to actually have any chance of understanding the origination of this virus, nor how one can prevent this kind of thing from happening again. But with respect to the broader set of issues, look, there is a global set of understandings, a global set of rules about a biological weapons program. The United States adheres closely to them. The Chinese Communist Party has always viewed global agreements, international understandings, as you do it and we'll see if it's convenient for us. That was certainly true of the Paris Climate
Accord. And generally it's not.
Yes. WTO rules, the list is long. That is certainly the case with their bioweapons programs. There's a lot we still don't know. We don't know the activities that they're engaged in, but we do know this. The world needs to hold account. You asked how one does that. There are many tools, international tools and tools, frankly, that the United States could take unilaterally that would cause the Chinese Communist Party to have real costs connected to what they did. We should take a good hard look. There are lawsuits in the United States that resulted from the harms that arose as a result of the Wuhan virus coming to the United States of America. We should look very carefully at whether the immunity rules that deny these plaintiffs actions in court inside the United States ought not appropriately be waived for certain purposes here to hold the Chinese Communist Party deeply accountable for what it is that they've done to the world.
One way this could be done, which we've talked about in the past, and I think would really help in a number of different respects, Secretary Pompeo, is to have the United States government designate the Chinese Communist Party as what it is, which is a transnational criminal organization. To your time in office, to your great credit, you, and for that matter, the Attorney General, Bill Barr, and the National Security Advisor to the President under Donald Trump, even Christopher Wray at the FBI, and I think this was in no small measure thanks to your leadership, all basically fleshed out a bill of particulars. You're a distinguished attorney. You know what that means. Documenting the criminal activity, crimes against humanity, and so much more that this Communist Party of China has engaged in. Don't you think that would be a step we should take in terms of holding them accountable?
You know, Frank, we made a lot of progress. Your point is true. We made a lot of progress at identifying the shortcomings, identifying the actual actions that they were taking, whether it was the genocide in the West or the terrible actions they're taking, permitting fentanyl to come into the United States in spite of commitments that they've made to the world that they wouldn't do that. You know, as for the actual designation, I'll leave that to lawyers to work on. We designated lots of senior officials from the senior leadership of the Chinese Communist Party, not only for the things we've been talking about, but for their actions against the people of Hong Kong as well. We used the powers of the Global Magnitsky Act in ways that we felt were necessary. There remains an awful lot more work to do. I am very worried that this administration won't continue down this path, and they'll turn to, frankly, what we did for 40 years. And Frank, this isn't political. Sometimes people say, oh, this is just, you know, the Republicans versus the Democrats. This is the Republicans had the wrong end of the stick for 30 years, too, and didn't confront this. This is really about protecting American workers, protecting the American people, and there's not a partisan tinge to it all. I was happy, frankly, during my time as Secretary of State that there were huge Democrat support for many of the actions that we took on China. I welcome that. The Chinese Communist Party needs to see that this is an American response, not a partisan one.
Amen. Just very quickly, we've got less than a minute left. You, on your way out the door, designated the Chinese Communist Party as the perpetrator of genocide. Your successor has said he identifies with that. Apparently, the policy is formally under review, but the president, Joe Biden, has said that, well, this is kind of a cultural norm and seemed to excuse it as such. What do you think?
Well, Secretary Blinken made clear he believed genocide had taken place and is ongoing. I made that statement very directly after an enormous internal review. Just like every time we designate someone, anytime we make a determination like this, it is historic. We wanted to make sure we were right, and I am 100% certain that we were right to do that. We now have to make sure that we follow up on that. We need nations all across the world to act. The Canadians made a statement yesterday, which was really strong and really good. I think decent human beings all across the world can see that forced sterilizations, labor camps, internment of these minorities inside of China is truly genocidal. And we need to make sure that the Chinese Communist Party pays a price for this genocidal activity and ultimately, I pray, changes their behavior.
Amen. And it should be a completely bipartisan effort on our part. Mr. Secretary, we have to let you go. Thank you for your time today, as well as your extremely important service to our country, which I know will continue at the Hudson Institute.
Frank, thank you. Great to be back with you, sir.
Amen. Bless you.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. It's always a delight to be able to say a special welcome to a man who makes his visits with us each week, really one of the high points of this program, and that is Gordon Chang. He is, of course, the duty expert on China for us and Fox News and so many others. He is also the author of The Coming Collapse of China and The Great U.S.-China Tech War. You can follow him at Gordon G. Chang on Twitter, as I do. And you'll be seeing a lot of him if you're following CPAC over the next couple of days, because he is one of their featured speakers and panelists. And we're always delighted to catch up with him, especially on a busy day. Thank you, Gordon, for taking the time to visit.
Oh, well, thank you so much.
I wanted to talk to you especially, Gordon, because earlier in the program, we had a very special appearance by the former Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, in which we were able to sort of reprise some of the most important things he did during his time in that role, namely helping clarify the nature of the Chinese Communist Party virus, its provenance, what happened to us as a result of it, particularly because the Chinese, as Matt Pottinger pointed out, were not forthcoming about the nature and the provenance, as I say, of the disease itself. And we also talked a bit about the other thing that he did on his way out the door, which was to designate the Chinese Communist Party as responsible for genocide in Western China. Just a quick, assessment of his time in office and his comments.
Well, Frank, you called him the best Secretary of State since the time of Thomas Jefferson. And yes, I'd have to agree with that. He was a great Secretary of State. He was great on day one. He was great on the last day. And as you discussed with Secretary Pompeo, on his next to last day, he designated with his quote-unquote determination, which is a formal determination from the State Department, that China was committing genocide and other crimes against humanity in Xinjiang. That was an important step, and we're going to see other countries, including Canada, follow it.
Yes, I hope so. We've seen their legislature say they should, but it remains to be seen whether the government will do it. But Gordon, I thought what was particularly important about that was he noted that they had done the requisite review to make that designation. They had checked all the boxes. The Biden administration, apart from the really offensive comment by President Biden, as we've discussed before, that this was just a sort of cultural norm, but the pretext for not designating it or affirming that designation by the Biden administration has been that, well, it wasn't necessarily done by the book, and we have to review the mechanics of how this designation was made. Secretary Pompeo seemed to be having none of that, and I certainly think the rest of us shouldn't either. Do you?
Well, certainly the Biden administration should affirm it. First of all, as Secretary Pompeo said, the reason why it took so long was they wanted to make sure that they got all their facts right, which is the reason why the designation occurred at the end of his term, not in the middle of it. More important, you have candidate Joe Biden calling China genocidal in August of last year when he was campaigning. Secretary Blinken, during his confirmation hearings on January 19th, said he agreed with Secretary Pompeo's determination. And indeed, all the facts show that China is committing genocide, as that term is defined in Article 2 of the Genocide Convention of 1948. But whether or not the Biden administration affirms that determination still applies. It's an official act of the State Department, and unless it is withdrawn, it is the determination of the United States.
Well, withdrawal is the question, I guess, isn't it? And you are so prolific, and thank heavens for that. But I particularly appreciated the piece that you've published this week at Gatestone Institute about what you call Biden's okaying the financing of Chinese military. That is a reversal from what the Trump administration was set to do. Talk a bit about the implications of Wall Street essentially underwriting our enemy, Gordon.
Well, China is able to develop nuclear weapons, ballistic missiles, its instruments of war, because we're financing them. We're investing into Chinese companies. And we're investing not only into Chinese companies that have formal links to the People's Liberation Army, we're investing into companies that benefit the Chinese military, even on the surface that there are no obvious connections. And the reason is, as President Trump mentioned in his executive order in November of last year, there's a doctrine of military-civil fusion. And this means that the military has first call on all of the technology of private companies, of every company, of every institution in Chinese society. So therefore, when we invest in a private company in China, we're investing in effect in the Chinese military.
So this is a very helpful point. It's bad enough that we're investing in companies that we know are tied to the People's Liberation Army because the Pentagon has so designated them. But basically, any of these investments are enabling the Chinese Communist Party and its military and intelligence assets and its oppression of human rights and so on, if that is the direction given to the companies by the state. So this is a place where there has been broad bipartisan opposition expressed to this practice. Do you think that will be something that will reverse this reversal ultimately, Gordon Chang?
We know that Wall Street has very much against President Trump's executive order that got American investors out of investing in China military-linked companies. They're going to be working now to repeal that executive order. And so that's the reason why it was so significant that the Biden's Treasury Department, Office of Foreign Assets Control, deferred the applicability of the executive order until May 27th. It was supposed to go into effect with regard to certain companies on January 28th. The Biden Treasury Department deferred it to May. This gives Wall Street much more time to work on this, which means that we've got to defend President Trump's executive order.
Indeed, we do. Gordon, quickly and lastly, I did want to ask you about another piece that you'd written the other day at The Hill, in which you talked about China's penetration of Europe and the question of whether Europe will actually defect to China in this struggle between basically the United States on the one hand and the Chinese Communist Party's PRC on the other. And this is interesting to me in particular, Gordon, because we have a new product coming out shortly from the Captive Nations Coalition of the Committee on the Present Danger, China, in which we go through the Belt and Road Initiative and the unbelievable gains that the Chinese have made towards using that as a means of dominating an immense number of nations. I think it's something like 145 now out of a total of 192 or 3 that have actually gotten into this in one form or fashion or another, or are in the process of doing so. Talk a little bit about where the Europeans, our nominal allies, are likely to align in this regard.
Well, a week ago, we had our president give a talk to the G7, Group of Seven, and also to the Munich Security Conference. And he talked about how it was important for the transatlantic alliance to contain China and Russia. And the reaction from the Europeans was, well, yeah, that sounds nice, but we're not going to help you, which really shows where Europe is at right now. In 2020, China, for the first time, became the European Union's largest trading partner when it comes to merchandise goods. We still are the largest trading partner of the EU when it comes to total trade, because that also includes services. But nonetheless, the perception that the United States is in terminal decline is something that China's been pushing, and it's something that people in the EU believe. So therefore, they're starting to align themselves with China, even though it's committing genocide, committing crimes against humanity, invading its neighbors, stealing everyone's intellectual property, violating its trade obligations. It doesn't really matter because they believe that China is ascendant. And so therefore, they're going to side with China. And it's going to take more than just speeches from President Biden to get the American influence back in Europe. Remember that Biden campaigned on the notion that we need to work with our allies. Well, our allies don't seem to be wanting to work with us, at least those in the European Union.
And to tie this all together, a particular problem is that in places like Italy and Greece, and I think a growing number of other countries in Europe, it's not just trade that's operating. The Chinese have actually brought the Belt and Road Initiative to bear as well, controlling ports, building ports, otherwise, installing Huawei communication systems and the like. And the sort of cumulative effect of all of this, Gordon, I think reinforces your central point, which is these allies may not be allies much longer, or at least reliable allies. And the danger for them, as well as for us, is that China intends to dominate them, as well as the United States, of course. This is not just something that they have in mind for us, right?
Oh, of course. China now is operating ports in Spain, Italy, and Greece. It is dominating the port business. You got to remember that the most important relationship in the 20th century was the transatlantic alliance. The United States and Europe stood together, two great wars, also during the Cold War, and now China seems to be breaking that relationship apart. And so we need to pay much more attention to what's occurring in Europe, because we do need our allies. There's no question about that. And we are going to need American leadership. And the question is whether Biden would be willing to provide it.
Whether he's capable of providing it, one, and whether the allies recognize that they need us as well. That's a point that we will be hammering home here at Secure Freedom Radio. Thank you, Gordon, for your contributions to that effort and so much more. Come back to us again next week, if you would. Next up, we will speak with somebody else right after this.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. I'm very pleased to say a special welcome to one of our regulars here at Secure Freedom Radio. He's a man who has served his country with great distinction in a variety of capacities over a very long and distinguished career. His name is Charles Sam Faddis. He has been, well, an army officer, a undercover operative of the Central Intelligence Agency, an assistant attorney general for Washington State, a candidate for Congress from Maryland, and these days he is the driving force behind a terrific online resource called And Magazine. You can find it at andmagazine.com, and when you do, you're going to find prominently displayed there a very important piece that he's written about a woman by the name of Deb Haaland, who most of us have probably never heard of before, but she is a member of Congress. She is also the nominee of the Biden-Harris administration to be our next Interior Secretary. And Sam has done some important spade work with others of our colleagues to assess her fitness for that office, in particular in light of some very troubling ties and past and apparently ongoing associations. Sam, it's good to have you with us. Thank you for this important piece about the Secretary-designate for the Interior Department, Deb Haaland, and tell us about it.
Well, about the only thing that most people, of course, have heard about Deb Haaland, if they're aware that she's been nominated at all, is that she's Native American. This is sort of the, you know, the current identity politics era in which we live, the same as we've only heard our Treasury Secretary is female. That has nothing to do with what we're talking about today. Unfortunately, Ms. Haaland has some very strong extremist ties, and most prominently, she's not just supported in her nomination, but really was pushed for the nomination by the Communist Party of the United States. Haaland is also directly linked to a group called ANSWER, which most people have never heard of, I'm sure, but it's a crazy extremist group, basically a North Korean front organization, and it essentially opposes American foreign policy everywhere on the planet, opposes Israel, and advocates on behalf of our arch enemies all around the globe. So,
including communist China, I think it's fair to say, not just its puppet.
Yeah, well, I mean, of course. I mean, these days, you know, once upon a time, the sponsor of choice for communist groups in the United States might have been the Soviet Union. Those days are long gone. Not that the Russians have gone away completely. These days, if that's what we're talking about, if you're a communist party, you are lashed up at the hip with the Chinese Communist Party. And that's not just an ideological thing, like they just happen to believe the same stuff. I mean, members of this party go back and forth all the time to communist China, and they function as a front organization for the Chinese communists here. So really leaves you with some very serious questions. Well, why is the Communist Party of the United States so adamant that Deb Haaland needs to be our Interior Secretary? And how is it that you can find online photographs of Deb Haaland literally holding signs for the ANSWER organization, this North Korea front organization, marching around at demonstrations? I would think anybody would find that troubling.
Talk about some of the specific associations with leading members of the Communist Party of the United States, Sam. It's not just, you know, affinity or support from the organization in the macro sense. There have been some longstanding and it seems rather important ties politically and ideologically to this candidate, including, as you mentioned, in terms of advocacy for her taking over this position.
Most prominently, I guess, is Judith LeBlanc. Judith LeBlanc is has been a member of the Chinese, there's a Freudian slip, the Communist Party of the United States of America, literally since back in the 70s. This is, you know, this is as dyed in the wool as you get, 50 years of this kind of stuff, and at various points has held all sorts of leadership positions, including being the number two person in the party. And LeBlanc and Deb Haaland have had a very close personal and work association for years now. And LeBlanc is really the point person on pushing Haaland. When I say pushing, I mean, this is not inferred. I mean, literally, the Communist Party of the United States, LeBlanc, put together a petition drive and obtained something like 16,000 signatures, which they presented to Joe Biden, to the Biden administration, more or less demanding that Deb Haaland, who is sort of their girl, be made Interior Secretary. So,
and I gather she also gathered a cohort of prominent, very leftist women to also support this candidacy. And there's a guy by the name of Della Plena, who was also, I gather, sort of part of this concerted effort by the Communist Party of the United States to secure a nomination for this woman. And Sam, all of that should be troubling, I guess, but talk a little bit about what the Interior Department does. Obviously, it has an important role with respect to the Indian nations, but what else could be of interest to the Communist Party if they were to get their girl, as you say, their woman, their, you know, favorite pick to be its leader?
Right. So, I mean, most people think about the Interior Department, you think about the Indian nations, or they think about things like national parks. All of that's part of it, but it also just owns a huge amount of federal land, which in parts of the country is massive, and it therefore owns controls all of the natural resources, everything under it, everything on it. So you have a really an incredibly powerful government agency with incredible control over our natural resources, and you're about to put in charge of it somebody who, well, I mean, it appears to be a communist. I think that's a question should be asked directly to her, but certainly lashed up with them, which maybe is the answer to, right, about why the Communist Party of the United States so very much wants her in this position so she can pursue their policies when it comes to our natural resources.
And again, this is not academic. Joe Biden has been already announcing decisions with respect to precluding energy exploitation of federal lands. So a person responsible for that portfolio is going to have considerable say, it would appear, over our energy security, among other things. And again, unfortunately, we're now on notice that the Chinese Communist Party, most especially, but I think the Marxists and Leninists and, you know, progressives and socialists and so on more generally, have it in for our country. It ought to be a complete non-starter, it would seem to me, that people who have these kinds of ties, and you're to be commended really for helping to identify them, would be anywhere near a position of such power. It's stunning.
Yeah, and I think, you know, you and I have had this conversation before, but I think the average American finds it so inconceivable that anybody really pays any attention to communist ideology these days, that when you use these terms, they kind of think, well, it must be kind of a kinder, gentler form of, whatever, some sort of fuzzy concept. But it's not really Stalin or Mao's communism, is it? I mean, go to the Communist Party of the United States' website, because it's out there. Read their entire platform, read their constitution. It's straight out of Mao and Stalin. Nothing has changed. It is the abolishment of the republic and the establishment of a communist totalitarian state here in the United States of America. That is expressly word for word what they're saying. Read it for yourself.
And we err at our extreme peril if we think they don't mean it. We think they're not actually working towards that end. We think that they wouldn't be using every available instrument and technique at their disposal. We're, again, look no further, Sam, as you have helped us do repeatedly on this program and on our television program, Securing America. Look no further than what the Chinese Communist Party is doing to advance these objectives of taking down our republic and installing in its place a totalitarian communist system. And to the extent that they're aided and abetted in that effort by people like LeBlanc and De La Plana of the Communist Party of the United States, you know, we are on notice that this is a very bad company to be keeping, and it should be disqualifying, it seems to me, for Deb Haaland. And we'll see whether the votes are there to prevent her from getting this job in the United States Senate, but I hope that at the very least they will be informed by your work at AND Magazine. Sam Faddis, again, thank you for your time today. Come back to us again soon. And I understand you're headed off to CPAC. We'll look forward to getting your reports on what happened there next week. In the meantime, take good care, and I hope the rest of you will join us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.